This is disc number 4.
Gabriel walked over and removed the towel from her hair. Heavy and wet, it tumbled riotously onto her dark shoulders. She lifted her face to be kissed and loosened the towel around her body. Maybe Shamron was right, Gabriel thought as she pulled him onto the bed. Maybe he would let Pasner go to Cyprus to meet with the Egyptian after all. They were both famished after making love. Gabriel sat at the small table in the kitchen, watching the news on television, while Chiara made fettuccine and mushrooms. She was wearing one of Gabriel's dress shirts, unbuttoned to her abdomen, and nothing else. How did you find out that I'd been arrested?
I read it in the newspapers like everyone else.
She poured him a glass of red wine.
You were all the rage in Buenos Aires.
What kind of work were you doing there?
You know I can't tell you that.
I know you were watching members of a Hezbollah cell. I just want to know whether you were part of the actual surveillance team or just an escort officer.
I was part of the team, she said. I don't do much escort work anymore.
Why did they pull you out?
Overexposure to the targets.
Elizabeth Halton's face appeared suddenly on the television screen.
Pretty girl, Chiara said. Why did they take her?
I may find out tomorrow. He told her about his trip to Cyprus.
What about your dinner with the Prime Minister?
Gabriel looked up from the television. How did you know about that?
Shamron told me.
So much for operational security, he said. What exactly did he say to you? She placed the fettuccine in the water to boil and sat down next to him.
He said that you had agreed to succeed Amos as director.
I've agreed to no such thing.
That's not what Shamron says.
Shamron has a long history of hearing exactly what he wants to hear. What else did he say?
He wants us to get our personal life in order as soon as possible. He doesn't think it's proper for the director to be living with a woman out of wedlock, especially one who happens to be an employee of the office. He thinks we should accelerate our wedding plans.
She placed a finger beneath his chin and turned his face toward hers.
You agree, don't you?
Oh, yes, of course, said Gabriel hastily. He had learned that any hesitation to engage in a discussion of wedding plans was always wrongly interpreted by Chiara as a reluctance to marry. We should get married as soon as possible.
When?
What do you mean?
It's a very simple question, Gabriel. When do you think we should get married?
Late spring, he said, before it gets too hot.
May?
May would be perfect. Chiara removed her fingertip from beneath Gabriel's chin and nibbled nervously at her nail.
How am I going to plan a wedding in 6 months?
Hire a professional planner to help you.
A wedding isn't an operation, Gabriel. It's supposed to be planned by a family, not a professional.
What about Gila Shamron? She's the closest thing to a mother I have.
Gila has enough on her plate at the moment looking after her husband.
All the more reason to ask her to help with the wedding. Trust me, she'll jump at the chance.
It's not a bad idea, actually. And no wonder Shamron wants you to be the chief. The first thing we have to do is settle on a guest list.
Now that's easy, Gabriel said. Just invite everyone from the office, Shabak, AMAN, most of the cabinet, and half of the Knesset. Oh, and don't forget the Prime Minister.
I'm not sure I want the Prime Minister to attend my wedding.
You're afraid of being overshadowed by a chubby octogenarian?
Yes.
The Prime Minister has 3 daughters of his own. He'll make certain not to steal the limelight on your big day.
Our big day, Gabriel.
The water began to boil over. She stood up and walked back to the stove.
Are you sure you have to go to Cyprus tomorrow?
I want to hear what the Egyptian has to say with my own ears.
But you've only just come home.
It's just for a day or two. Why don't you come with me? You can work on that suntan of yours.
It's cold in Cyprus this time of year.
So, you want me to go alone?
I'll come, she said. You didn't say anything about the way I decorated the apartment. Do you like it?
Oh, yes, he said hastily. It's lovely.
I found a ring on the coffee table. Did you put a hot drink on it without a coaster?
It was oozy,
Gabriel said.
Chiara poured the fettuccine into a colander and frowned.
He's such a slob, she said. I don't know how Bella can live with him.
Chapter 14. The items she had requested lay arranged on an adjacent cot. Isopropyl alcohol, cotton swabs, rubber gloves, tweezers, needle-nose pliers, a straight razor, codeine, and cephalin tablets, 4x4 sterile pads, medical tape, 2 18-inch strips of wood, 2 rolls of bandaging, and 2 liters of bottled water. She held out her cuffed hands to the one she thought of as Kane. He shook his head.
I can't do this with my hands cuffed.
He hesitated, then removed them.
The drugs you gave me after you kidnapped me. You have more, I assume?
Another hesitation, then a reluctant nod.
I need them. Otherwise your friend is going to suffer terribly.
He walked over to the van and returned a moment later with a syringe wrapped in plastic and a vial of clear liquid. Elizabeth looked at the label. Ketamine. No wonder she'd suffered such terrible hallucinations while the drug was in her system. Anesthesiologists almost never used ketamine without a secondary sedative, such as Valium. These idiots had given her several injections of the drug with nothing to blunt its side effects. She loaded an appropriate dosage, 250 milligrams, and injected it into the wounded man's upper arm. As he slipped slowly into unconsciousness, she broke the needle off the syringe and placed it in the plastic sack from the chemist's shop, where Kane had purchased the medical supplies. The name and address of the shop were written on the bag in blue lettering. Elizabeth recognized the village. It was located on the Norfolk coastline, northeast of London. She lifted the blanket and adjusted the lamp so that the light shone directly into the wound. The round was lodged within the fracture fragments. She opened the bottle of rubbing alcohol and poured a generous amount directly into the wound, then wiped away the pus and other infectious material with a cotton swab. When the wound was sufficiently clean, she sterilized the straight razor and used it to debride the ragged necrotic material along the edges. Then she sterilized the tweezers and spent the next 20 minutes carefully removing fragments of shattered bone and filaments of embedded fabric. Finally, she sterilized the needle-nose pliers and slipped them carefully into the wound. The round was out a moment later, deformed from its impact with the terrorist's tibia, but intact. She gave the bullet to Kane as a souvenir and prepared for the final stage of the procedure, the dressing and the splint. First, she flushed the wound thoroughly with the sterile water, then covered it with a 4x4 sterile pad. Last, she laid the 2 strips of wood along each side of his lower leg from knee to the ankle and bound the splint tightly with the rolls of bandaging. When she was finished, she propped the leg on a pillow and looked at Kane.
When he wakes up, give him 2 of the cephalin tablets. Then give him 1 tablet every 4 hours. Keep the leg elevated. I'd like to see him every 2 hours, if that's possible. If not, I've given you 72 hours at the most. After that, he's going to need to go into a hospital.
She held out her hands. Kane applied the cuffs and led her downstairs to her cell. As she lay down on her cot, she felt an almost drunken sense of elation. The crude surgery, the brisk commands. She had been in control, if only for a few moments, and she had managed to uncover a single piece of valuable information. She was still in England, still within reach of the British police and intelligence services. She closed her eyes and tried to sleep, but an hour later she was jolted by a knock at the door. "We have a present for you," the note said. "Lay down on your cot." She did as she was told, and watched as Kane and Abel entered her cell. They put packing tape across her mouth and a hood over her head. She fought them. She fought them even after they gave her the needle. Chapter 15. Cyprus, 10:15 a.m., Friday. Much can be gleaned about the value of a source by the accommodations that are made to handle him. For the debriefings of Wazir al-Zayat, the office had purchased a lovely whitewashed villa on the southern coast of Cyprus, with a small swimming pool and a shaded terrace overlooking the Mediterranean Sea. Gabriel and Chiara arrived several hours before the Egyptian was due. Gabriel had hoped to spend the time relaxing, but Chiara, alone with him for the first time in weeks, wanted to use the opportunity to discuss wedding plans. Place settings and flowers, guest lists and music. This is how Israel's legendary secret agent passed the time before the arrival of the Egyptian spy. He wondered what Aretz and the rest of the Israeli newspapers would write about him if they knew the truth. Shortly after 2 in the afternoon, Gabriel glimpsed a Volkswagen sedan speeding along the coast road. It passed by the villa and disappeared around a bend, then, 5 minutes later, approached from the opposite direction. This time it slowed and turned into the drive. Gabriel looked at Chiara.
"You'd better wait upstairs in the bedroom," he said. "From what I've read about Wazir, your presence will only be a distraction."
Chiara gathered up her papers and bridal magazines and vanished. Gabriel went into the kitchen and opened one of the cabinets. Inside was the control panel for the built-in recording system. He put in a fresh set of tapes and pressed the record button, then went into the entrance hall and opened the front door as El Zayat was coming up the steps. The Egyptian froze and regarded Gabriel suspiciously for a moment through the lenses of his mirrored sunglasses. Then a trace of a smile appeared beneath his dense mustache, and he extended a club-like hand in Gabriel's direction.
"To what do I owe the honor, Mr. Alon?"
"Something came up in Rome," Gabriel said. "Shimon asked me to fill in."
The Egyptian pushed his sunglasses onto his forehead and studied Gabriel again, this time with obvious skepticism. His eyes were dark and bottomless. They were not a pair of eyes Gabriel would ever want to see on the other side of an interrogation table.
"Or maybe you volunteered to come here to see me," the Egyptian said.
"Now, why would I do that, Wazir?"
"Because if what I read in the newspapers is true, you now have something of a personal stake in the outcome of this case."
"You shouldn't believe everything you read in the newspapers."
"At least not the Egyptian papers."
Al-Zayat followed Gabriel into the villa, then walked over to the drinks cabinet with a proprietary air and loosened the cap on a new bottle of single malt scotch.
"You'll join me?"
he asked, waving the bottle at Gabriel.
"I'm driving,"
Gabriel replied.
"What is it with you Jews and alcohol?"
"It makes us do silly things with lampshades."
"What kind of agent runner doesn't have a drink with a sauce?"
Al-Zayat poured himself a very large glass and put the cap back on the bottle without tightening it.
"But then, you are not an agent runner, are you, Alon?"
He drank half the whiskey in a single swallow.
"How's the old man? Back on his feet?"
"Shimron is fine," Gabriel said. "He sends his regards."
"I hope he sent more than regards."
Gabriel looked at the leather briefcase laying in a rectangle of sunlight on the sailcloth couch. Al-Zayat sat next to it and popped the latches. Satisfied by the contents, he closed the briefcase and looked at Gabriel.
"I know who kidnapped the ambassador's daughter," he said, "and I know why they did it. Where would you like me to start?"
"The beginning," said Gabriel. "It tends to put things in proper perspective."
"You're just like Shimron."
"Yes, I've heard that."
The Egyptian's gaze wandered over the bag again.
"There's 50,000, right?"
"You can count it if you like."
"That won't be necessary. Do you want me to sign a receipt?"
"You sign the receipt when you get the money," Gabriel said.
"And you get your money after I hear the information." "Shimon always gave me the money first."
"I'm not Shimon."
The Egyptian swallowed the rest of his whiskey. Gabriel refilled his glass and told him to start talking. The beginning, the Egyptian said, was the day in September 1970 when Nasser died and his vice president, Anwar Sadat, came to power in Egypt. Nasser had regarded Egypt's Islamic radicals, especially the Muslim Brotherhood, as a grave threat to his regime, and had used mass arrests, executions, and torture to keep them in their place. Sadat had tried a different approach.
"Sadat had none of Nasser's charisma and no popular base of support," Al-Zayat said. "He was also a rather religious man. He was more afraid of the communists and the Nasserites than the brothers, And so he made what would turn out to be a fatal reversal of Egypt's approach to Islamic extremism. He branded the communists and the Nasserites as enemies of his new regime and let the brothers out of jail. And then he compounded the mistake, El-Zayat explained. He allowed the Muslim Brotherhood to operate openly and encouraged them to spread their fiery brand of Islam abroad, especially into the newly occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. He also encouraged and funded the creation of groups that were even more radical than the Brotherhood. One was El-Gama'a al-Islamiya, or the Islamic Group. Another was Al-Jihad. In October 1981, Al-Jihad turned on the man who had helped bring it into existence, assassinating Sadat as he stood on a military reviewing stand outside Cairo. In the eyes of the Islamists, Sadat's sins were many, but none so egregious as his peace treaty with Israel. Before opening fire, Sadat's assassin, Lieutenant Khaled Izalambouli, screamed, "I have killed Pharaoh, and I do not fear death." "The Gama'a and Al-Jihad, of course, are with us still," Al-Zayat said. "Their goal is to destroy the Mubarak regime, replace it with an Islamic Republic, and then use Egypt as a base of operations to wage a global jihad against the West and Israel. Both groups are signatories of Al-Qaeda's declaration of war against the Crusaders and the Jews, and both are formally under the umbrella of Osama bin Laden's command structure. Egyptians make up more than half of Al-Qaeda's core personnel, and they hold 5 of the 9 positions in the ruling Shura Council. And of course, Osama's right-hand man is Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Jihad."
"So, Egypt is no different than the Saudis," Gabriel said. "You thought you could reach accommodation with the Islamic terrorists by giving them money and encouragement and deflecting their rage outward, and now they're threatening to destroy you."
"You did the same thing, my friend. Don't forget that the office and Shabak gave money and support to Hamas in the early days because you thought the Islamists were a good counterweight to the secular leftists of the PLO.
"Point taken," Gabriel said. "But please don't tell me I'm supposed to pay you $50,000 to tell me that Al-Qaeda is responsible for kidnapping the daughter of the American ambassador to London. I could have saved my money and just turned on CNN instead. They have lots of experts saying the same thing."
"It's not just Al-Qaeda," Al-Zayat said. "It's a joint operation, a merging of assets, if you will."
"Who's the other partner?"
The Egyptian walked over to the drinks cabinet and refilled his glass.
"There were other groups besides the Gama'a and Al-Jihad that formed in the 70s, more than 50 in all. Some were just cells of university students that couldn't organize a bucket brigade. Others were good. Very good."
He took a drink of the whiskey.
"Unfortunately, a group that sprang up at the University of Minya was one of the good ones. They called themselves the Sword of Allah."
The Sword of Allah. Gabriel knew the name, of course. Anyone who worked in the field of Islamic terrorism did. In the late 1970s, after Sadat's historic visit to Jerusalem, a group of university students, professors, and civil servants from the upper Egyptian town of Minya had coalesced around a fiery Islamic cleric named Sheikh Tayyib Abdul Razak. Sheikh Tayyib adopted a simple program for seizing power in Egypt: inflict as much terror and bloodshed on Egyptian society as possible, and the regime would collapse under its own weight. In the early 1990s, he nearly succeeded. Flushed with the prospects of success, the Sheikh decided to take his campaign global long before there was such a thing known as Al-Qaeda. He sent emissaries to Europe to open branch offices of the Sword among the burgeoning Muslim communities there, and dispatched his older brother and closest advisor, Sheikh Abdullah Abdul Razak, to suburban Washington to wage jihad against the most important patron of the Egyptian regime, the government of the United States. In 1998, Sheikh Abdullah was found guilty on charges of conspiring to bomb the State Department, the Capitol, and the headquarters of the FBI, and was sentenced to life in prison. He had recently been diagnosed with cancer. Freeing the Sheikh before his death was now one of the Sword's top priorities.
"Al-Qaeda has been itching to hit London again for a long time.
El-Zayat said. And of course, Sheikh Tayyib wants to get his brother back from the Americans. They decided to merge the two priorities into a single terror spectacular. Al-Qaeda handled the bombings, while the Sword and its European network saw to the hostage-taking side of the operation.
What evidence do you have of Sword involvement?
You had the proof in your own hands for a few seconds in Hyde Park, the Egyptian said. Samir al-Masri, former student of engineering at the University of Minya, is a member of the Sword of Allah, and one of its more talented terrorist operatives.
It would have been helpful, Vazir, if you told the Dutch he was living quietly in West Amsterdam.
We didn't know he was in Holland, or we would have.
The Egyptian sat down on the couch next to his bag of money.
Samir left Egypt a few months after the Americans went into Iraq. When the insurgency started up, he joined forces with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and perfected his craft. Apparently, he slipped out of Iraq shortly before Zarqawi's death and made his way to Europe via Damascus. If you want to blame anyone for the fact that Samir was living quietly in West Amsterdam, blame the Syrians. And the Dutch, of course. Christ, they let anyone into their country.
What else do you have besides Samir's connection?
The Al-Hisra Mosque.
What about it?
The Imam there is a graduate of Al-Azhar in Cairo and a member of the Sword of Allah.
That's still not enough.
This discussion is academic, Al-Zayat said. In 24 hours you'll have proof the Sword of Allah is behind this. That's when they'll offer to trade Elizabeth Halton for Sheikh Abdullah.
How can you be so sure about the timing?
The Sword has carried out a number of kidnappings inside Egypt. Most of the time the outside world doesn't even hear about them. Their method of operation is always the same. They wait 1 week before making demands, and if they set a deadline for killing the girl, they'll do it when the second hand reaches 12. And there won't be any extensions or delays.
The Americans will never release Sheikh Abdullah.
If they don't, the Sword of Allah and Al-Qaeda are going to send the American president's goddaughter home in a bag. Or what's left of her, I should say. They'll kill her the same way they took her, with a great deal of bloodshed.
Have you told the Americans about any of this?
Al-Zayat shook his head.
Why not?
Orders from on high, said Al-Zayat. Our fearless leader is afraid his patrons in Washington will be angry when they find out the plot to kidnap the ambassador's daughter originated in Egypt. He's trying to delay the day of reckoning as long as possible. In the meantime, he's directed the SSI and the other security services to gather as much intelligence as possible.
Who's the mastermind?
If I had to guess, it goes all the way to the top.
Zawahiri?
The Egyptian nodded.
But surely there's someone between him and the operatives, Gabriel said. Someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, someone who made the trains run on time.
There is.
Al-Zayat held his tumbler of whiskey up to the sunlight and contemplated its color for a moment without speaking.
And if I had to venture a guess as to his identity, I'd say it's almost certainly the work of the Sphinx.
Who's the Sphinx?
We're not sure who he is, but we know his handiwork all too well. All told, he's killed more than 1,000 people inside Egypt. Tourists, government ministers, wealthy friends of the regime. We assume he's highly educated and very well connected. We believe he has agents of influence and spies at the highest level of Egyptian society and government, including inside my service. He operates through cutouts like Samir. We've never been able to get close to him.
Could he have planned something like this from Egypt?
Highly unlikely, Al-Zayat said. He's probably in Europe. In fact, I'd be willing to wager a fair amount of money that he is. The Sword has been very quiet in Egypt for the last year. Now we know why.
Where's Sheikh Tayyib?
The same place he's been for the last 15 years, underground. He moves between a string of hideouts in Upper Egypt and the oasis towns of the Western Desert.
We also think he moves in and out of Libya and the Sudan.
Find him, Gabriel said.
Elizabeth Halton will be dead long before we ever find the Sheikh.
Start rounding up SWORD operatives and bringing them in for quiet chats. That's your specialty, isn't it, Wazir?
Quiet chats with Islamic extremists? Let he who is without sin cast the first stone,
Al-Zayat replied.
Trust me, Alon. We are kicking down doors as we speak. But the Sphinx knew we would. No one in Egypt knows where the girl is. I doubt even Sheikh Tayeb knows the operational details. Your best chance at finding her alive died with Samir al-Masri. The sword is good at hiding people.
Someone knows, Gabriel said. Someone has to know.
The Sphinx knows. Find the Sphinx, and you'll find the girl.
The Egyptian put his hand on the grip of the briefcase.
So, have I earned my 50,000 yet?
I want everything you have on the Sword of Allah, Gabriel said. Case files, membership rolls, known front organizations in Europe, names, addresses, telephone numbers.
It's in a suitcase in the trunk of my car, the Egyptian said. But it's going to cost you.
Gabriel sighed.
How much, Wazir?
Another 50,000.
I don't happen to have another 50,000 on me.
The Egyptian smiled.
I'll take an IOU, he said. I know you're good for it.
The Samsonite suitcase that Wazir al-Zayat produced from the trunk of his rented Volkswagen contained the lifeblood of one of the world's most violent terror organizations, and was therefore a steal at 50,000. When the Egyptian was gone, Gabriel opened a directory of known SWORD members and started reading. 5 minutes later, he came across a name that was familiar to him. He located a photocopy of the corresponding file and examined the photograph. It was dated and of poor quality. Even so, Gabriel could tell it was the same man he had encountered a week earlier in Amsterdam.
I'm the person you're looking for in Solomon Rosner's files, the man had said to him that night. And I've come to help you.
Chapter 16. Paris, 3:45 p.m. Friday. The knock was cautious and contrite. Dr. Youssef Ramadan, professor of Near Eastern History at American University in Cairo, looked up from his work and saw a woman standing in the doorway of his office. Like all female employees of the Institute of Islamic Studies, she was veiled. Even so, the professor averted his eyes slightly as she spoke.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Professor, but if it's all right with you, I'll be leaving now. Of course, Atifa. Can I get you anything before I go? More tea, perhaps? I've had too much already.
He glanced at his wristwatch.
In fact, I'm going to be leaving soon myself. I'm meeting a colleague from the Sorbonne for coffee at 4:30. Don't forget your umbrella. It's still raining. It's been raining for 5 days. Welcome to Paris. Peace be upon you, Professor Ramadan. And you, Atifa.
The woman slipped out of the office and quietly closed the door. Ramadan spent another 10 minutes tapping away at the keyboard of his laptop computer, then placed the computer and his research files into his briefcase and stood up. He was slender and bearded, with receding curly hair, soft brown eyes, and the fine aquiline features often associated with Egyptian aristocracy. He was not of aristocratic birth. Indeed, the man now regarded as one of Egypt's most influential intellectuals and writers was born the son of a postal clerk in a poor village at the edge of the Fayoum Oasis. Brilliant, charismatic, and a self-professed political moderate, he had taken a leave of absence from the university 18 months earlier and signed on as a visiting scholar-in-residence with the Institute. The ostensible purpose of his stay in Paris was to complete his masterwork, a critical re-examination of the Crusades that promised to be the standard against which all future books on the subject would be measured. When he was not writing, Professor Ramadan could often be seen in the lecture halls of the Sorbonne, or on French television, or even in the corridors of government power. Embraced wholeheartedly by the intelligentsia and media of Paris, his opinions were much in demand on matters ranging from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict
to the American occupation of Iraq, and of course, the scourge of Islamic terror, a topic with which he was intimately familiar. He walked over to his narrow window and looked down into the Boulevard de la Chapelle, dark and raw, a half-hearted drizzle, Paris in winter. It had been many days since the sun had made its last appearance, and even then it was only a furtive peek from behind the blanket of cloud. Ramadan longed to be back in Cairo. The thunder of the traffic, the smells both putrid and magical, the music of a thousand muezzins, the kiss of the desert wind at night. It had been 6 months since his last visit. Soon, he thought. Soon it would be over and he would go home again. And if things went according to plan, the country to which he would return would be very different from the one he had left behind. Strange to think it had all been set in motion here, in dreary Paris, from his tiny office in the 18th arrondissement. He pulled on his overcoat and hat, then snatched up his briefcase and umbrella and stepped into the corridor. As he passed by the staff lounge, he saw several colleagues gathered around the television, watching a briefing by the Commissioner of London's Metropolitan Police. Mahmoud Abourish, the tubby, owl-like director of the Institute, motioned for Ramadan to join him. Ramadan walked over and looked up at the screen.
What's he saying?
No word yet from the kidnappers, said Abourish, and no clues about the woman's whereabouts.
Do you believe him?
The British are very good, but judging from the expression on that man's face, he's not holding any cards up his sleeve.
Abourish regarded Ramadan through his smudged glasses.
You're the resident expert on matters like these, Yusuf. Who do you think has kidnapped this woman? And what on earth do they want?
I suppose we'll know soon enough, Ramadan said.
How goes the writing?
It goes, Mahmoud, just not as quickly as I had hoped. In fact, I'm having drinks with my French publisher in a few minutes to tell him I won't be able to deliver the manuscript on time. He's not going to be pleased. Neither are my British and American publishers.
Is there anything the Institute can do?
You've done more than you'll ever know, Mahmoud.
Abourish gazed toward the television as Dame Eleanor Mackenzie, the Director General of MI5, stepped before the television cameras. Yusuf Ramadan, the man known to Egyptian security services only as the Sphinx, slipped silently from the lounge and headed downstairs. Though Yusuf Ramadan had been far from forthright during his brief encounter with Mahmoud Abourish, he had been truthful about one thing. He was indeed having drinks with his French publisher that evening, at Fouquet's, on the Champs-Élysées to be precise, but not until 5 o'clock. He had one appointment before then, however, on the Quai de Montebello, directly across the Seine from Notre Dame. The man waiting for him there was tall and heavily built, dressed in a dark cashmere overcoat with a silk scarf knotted rakishly at his throat. His real name was Nidal Mutawali, although Ramadan referred to him only as Abu Musa. Like Ramadan, he was from the Fayoum Oasis. They had grown up together, attended school together, and then gone their separate ways. Ramadan into the world of books and writing, Abu Musa into the world of finance and money. The jihad and their shared hatred of the Egyptian regime and its American backers had reunited them. It was Abu Musa, Yusuf Ramadan's childhood friend, who allowed him to keep his identity a secret from the Egyptian security services. They were, quite literally, two of the most dangerous men on earth. A light drizzle was drifting through the lamplight along the Seine embankments and beating like teardrops on the plastic sheets covering the stalls of the bouquinistes. Ramadan wandered over to a trestle table stacked with books and thumbed a worn volume of Chekhov. Abu Musa joined him a moment later and picked up a copy of L'Étranger by Camus. "Have you read him?" Abu Musa asked.
"Of course," said Ramadan. "I'm sure you'll find it to your liking."
Ramadan moved on to the next table of books. Abu Musa joined him again a moment later, and again they exchanged a few harmless-sounding words. On it went like this for the next 10 minutes as they moved slowly together down the row of booksellers, Ramadan leading, Abu Musa trailing after him. "I've always enjoyed the poetry of Dryden. I saw this play the last time I was in London. The DVD has been shot and is ready to be handed over. We're ready to make the phone call on your orders." Ramadan picked up a copy of Hemingway and held it up for Abu Musa to see.
"This has always been one of my favorites," he said. "Allow me to give it to you as a gift."
He handed the bookseller a 5-euro note. Then, after jotting a brief inscription on the title page of the volume, presented it formally to Abu Musa with his hand over his heart. They parted a moment later as Emmanuel, the 13-ton bell in Notre Dame's South Tower, tolled 5 o'clock. Abu Musa disappeared into the streets of the Latin Quarter. Yusuf Ramadan crossed to the other side of the river and walked in the Tuileries Gardens, thinking about the question Mahmoud Abourish had posed to him earlier that afternoon. Who do you think has kidnapped this woman, and what on earth do they want? Because of the meeting that had just transpired in plain sight along the banks of the Seine, the Americans soon would be told the answers to those questions. Whether they chose to inform the rest of the world was none of Professor Ramadan's concern, at least not yet. He walked for several minutes more in the gardens, checking his tail for signs of surveillance and thinking about his pending meeting with his French publisher on the Champs-Élysées. He supposed he had to come up with some suitable explanation as to why his book was now hopelessly behind schedule. He would think of something. The Sphinx was an extremely good liar. Chapter 17. U.S. Embassy, London, 5:19 p.m., Friday. There was one telephone in the makeshift operations center that was never used for outgoing calls. It was attached to a sophisticated digital recording device and linked to the call tracing network of the Metropolitan Police. The receiver itself was red, and the ringer volume was set to foghorn level. Only one person was allowed to touch it: Supervisory Special Agent John O'Donnell, head of the FBI's Critical Incident Response Group and the Bureau's chief hostage negotiator. The telephone had rung 47 times since the disappearance of Elizabeth Halton. Thus far, none of the calls had been deemed credible by O'Donnell or his counterparts at the Met. Though the demands of some of the callers had managed to provide a few brief interludes of comedy in what were otherwise very dark days. One caller said he would release Elizabeth Halton in exchange for the sum of 100,000 British pounds. O'Donnell agreed to the deal, and the man was arrested later that evening in the parking lot of a pub in West Sussex. One demanded a date with a famous American actress of questionable talent. One said he would free his American captive in exchange for tickets to that weekend's Arsenal-Chelsea football match. One called because he was depressed and needed someone to talk to. O'Donnell chatted with him for 5 minutes to make sure Scotland Yard had a good trace and bade the man good evening as officers moved in for the arrest. The call that arrived at the embassy's main switchboard shortly after 6 that evening was different from the start. The voice was male and electronically disguised, the first caller to employ such a device.
"I have information about Elizabeth Halton," he calmly told the switchboard operator. "Transfer me to the appropriate individual. If more than 5 seconds elapse, I will hang up and she will die. Do you understand me?"
The operator made it clear that she did indeed understand and politely asked the caller to stand by. 2 seconds later, O'Donnell's phone sounded in the ops center. He snatched the red receiver from the cradle and brought it quickly to his ear.
"This is John O'Donnell of the Federal Bureau of Investigation," he said crisply. "How can I help you?"
"The beach at Beacon Point,"
the electronically altered voice said.
"Look beneath the overturned rowboat. This will be our first and only contact."
The line went dead. O'Donnell hung up the phone and listened to the call again on his recorder, then picked up the receiver of a separate dedicated line that rang automatically at Scotland Yard.
"That sounded legit to me," O'Donnell said.
"I concur,"
said the Met officer at the other end of the line.
"Did you get a trace?"
"It was placed with a mobile phone. Something tells me we're not going to catch this one. He sounded like a real pro."
"Where's Beacon Point?"
"The south coast, about 10 miles east of Plymouth."
"How far from central London?"
About 150 miles.
"I want to be on site for the retrieval, whatever it is."
"The Royal Navy has been kind enough to leave a Sea King at the London heliport for just this kind of scenario."
"Where's the heliport?"
"South bank of the Thames, between the Battersea and Wandsworth bridges."
"Tell them to warm up the engines. Can you give me a lift through town?"
"I'll have a pair of patrol cars outside the embassy in 2 minutes.
"Send them to Upper Brook Street," O'Donnell said. "There are no reporters back there."
"Right."
The flight to the south coast was 90 minutes in duration,
and thoroughly unpleasant because of high winds swirling ahead of a strong Atlantic storm front. As the Sea King swooped down toward Beacon Point, O'Donnell looked out his window and saw arc lamps blazing away on the little sand beach and blue police lights flashing along roads linking the surrounding villages of Kingston, Houghton, and Ringmore. The landing zone was a small patch of moorland behind the beach. O'Donnell was met there by the officer in charge, a stubby deputy chief constable from the Devon and Cornwall Constabulary, aptly named Blunt. He briefed the FBI man as they walked down a sandy pathway to the beach.
"We've determined that the beach and surrounding grounds are free of bombs or any other weaponry," he said. "About 20 minutes ago, we used a remote-control robotic device to have a look under the overturned boat."
"Anything there?" O'Donnell asked.
"Nothing that we could see with the camera, but it's possible something could be buried beneath it. We decided to wait until you arrived before moving the boat."
They clambered out of the dunes and stopped about 20 yards from the boat. An 8-foot dinghy with peeling gray and white paint. It was surrounded by a half-dozen policemen in blast protection suits and visors. With a terse nod, Blunt spurred them into action, and the boat was soon resting on its hull. Taped to the seat in the stern was a DVD in a clear plastic case. Blunt retrieved it and immediately handed it to O'Donnell, who carried it back to the helicopter and inserted it into a laptop computer. As the image flickered to life on the screen, O'Donnell swore beneath his breath and looked at the British police official.
"I need a favor from you."
"Anything," said Blunt, his tone grave.
"Tell your men it was just a hoax. Apologize to them for the inconvenience and thank them on behalf of the American people and Ambassador Halton for their fine work tonight."
"I'm afraid I don't understand, Mr. O'Donnell."
O'Donnell glanced at the screen.
"This DVD does not exist. Now do you understand?"
Blunt nodded. He understood perfectly. Chapter 18. Andrews Air Force Base. 7:12 a.m. Saturday. The Gulfstream 5 executive jet touched down at Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington and taxied to a secure hangar with floors as smooth as polished marble. Gabriel descended the air stair, Samsonite bag in hand, and headed toward a waiting Suburban with Virginia license plates. The two CIA security men inside did not speak as he tossed the suitcase into the back seat and climbed in after it. Gabriel was used to this sort of behavior by the Americans. They were trained by their counterintelligence people to believe that office agents viewed every encounter with agency personnel, no matter how mundane, as an opportunity for intelligence gathering. He was tempted to pose an inappropriate question or two, just to keep the myth alive. Instead, he asked only where they were taking him.
"Headquarters," said the man in the passenger seat.
"I don't want to go to headquarters."
"You'll go into the building black. No one will know you're there."
"Why can't we meet in a safe house, the way we usually do?"
"Your contact doesn't have time to leave the building today. I'm sure you can understand that."
Gabriel was about to object again, but stopped himself. Twice in the past year, his photograph had appeared in the world's newspapers, once for his actions inside the Vatican, and again for his attempt to prevent the kidnapping of Elizabeth Halton. Making his first appearance at Langley didn't seem to matter much in comparison. Besides, if Chamron and the Prime Minister had their way, it wouldn't be his last. There was little traffic on the road at that hour on a Saturday, and it took them just 30 minutes to make the drive from Andrews to the woods of Langley. After a brief pause at the heavily fortified gatehouse for a credential check, they headed up the long, immaculate drive toward the OHB, the original headquarters building. Because Gabriel was entering the building black, they sped past the main entrance and turned into an underground parking garage. One of the security men helped Gabriel with the Samsonite bag. The other led the way into a secure elevator. A card key was inserted. Buttons were pushed, and a moment later they were ascending rapidly toward the 7th floor. When the doors opened, 2 more security men were waiting in the foyer, guns visible beneath their blazers. Gabriel was escorted along a carpeted corridor to a secure door, beyond which lay a suite of spacious offices, occupied by the most powerful intelligence officers in the world. The man standing in the anteroom, dressed in gray flannel trousers and a wrinkled Oxford cloth shirt, looked as though he had wandered in by mistake.
"How was the flight?" asked Adrian Carter.
"You have a very nice plane."
He shook Gabriel's hand warmly and looked at the bag.
"Planning to stay long, or just a day or two?" Only as long as I'm welcome, Gabriel said.
I hope you brought more than clean shirts and underwear.
I did.
Carter gave a fatigued smile and led Gabriel wordlessly into his office. Gabriel accepted a cup of black coffee and lowered himself onto Carter's couch. Carter picked up a remote control from the edge of his tidy desk and fired it at a bank of television monitors. Elizabeth Halton's image immediately appeared on one of the screens. She was seated on the floor of a featureless room, dressed in the same cold-weather running suit she had been wearing in Hyde Park the morning of her kidnapping. In her hands was a copy of The Times, headlined with her own abduction. Four men were standing behind her, black jumpsuits, black balaclavas, green headbands with crossed swords and crescent moons. The one directly behind Elizabeth had a large knife in one hand and a sheet of paper in the other. He was reading a statement in Egyptian-accented Arabic.
I take it you don't require translation? Carter said.
Gabriel, listening intently, shook his head.
He says he's from the Sword of Allah.
He says they want you to release Sheikh Abdullah Abul Razak from prison and return him to Egypt by 6 p.m., London time, next Friday. He says that if you don't comply with their demands, the ambassador's daughter will die. There will be no extensions, no negotiations, and no more contact. If there is any attempt at a rescue, Elizabeth Halton will be killed immediately.
The image turned to hash. Carter killed it with a flick of his remote and looked at Gabriel.
You don't seem surprised.
I learned about the Sword of Allah connection yesterday. It's why I'm here.
How did you find out?
Sources and methods, Adrian. Sources and methods.
Come now, Carter said mildly. A woman's life is at stake. Now is not the time to be territorial.
Just because we are technically at peace with Egypt doesn't mean we don't spy on them. We need to know whether the regime is going to stand or fall. We need to know whether we are about to be facing a hostile Islamic Republic armed with advanced American weaponry. And we don't always get the information we need from our friends here at Langley.
Your spy is SSI, I take it.
Gabriel gave a sigh of resignation.
Our spy is in the business of keeping Mubarak and his regime alive.
Carter took that as confirmation of his suspicions.
Why is it that we've spent upward of $50 billion propping up that regime, but you found out about the sword connection before we did?
Because we're better than you, Adrian, especially in the Middle East. We've always been better, and we always will be.
You have your unquestioned military might and the power of your economy. But we have a nagging fear that we might not survive. Fear is a far more powerful motivation than money.
Carter placed the remote thoughtfully on his desk and sat down in his executive swivel chair.
When did you get the video?
Gabriel asked. Carter told him.
Has word gotten out to the British media?
Not yet, Carter said.
It's our wish that it doesn't. At least not right away. We'd like to preserve the luxury of planning our response without the media screaming at us at every turn.
I wouldn't count on MI5 and Scotland Yard safeguarding your secret for long. Someone will leak it, just the way they leaked my involvement and arrest.
Don't be too hard on Graham Seymour, Carter said. We need him, and so do you. We brethren of the secret world don't burn each other at the stake at times like these. We band together and bind our wounds. We have to. The barbarians are at the gates.
The barbarians broke down the gates a long time ago, Adrian. They're living among us now and devouring our children.
Gabriel sipped his coffee.
What is the position of the president?
It's not one I'd wish on my worst enemy, Carter replied.
As you know, he is a deeply religious man, and he takes his responsibilities as Elizabeth's godfather very seriously. That said, he knows that if he complies with the demands of the kidnappers, no American diplomat anywhere in the world will ever be safe again. He also knows that if Sheikh Abdullah Abul Razak is allowed to return to Egypt, the Mubarak government will find itself in a very precarious state. For all its problems, Egypt is still the most important country in the Arab world. If Egypt goes Islamic, it will have a disastrous ripple effect across the entire region. Disastrous for my country and yours.
That means Elizabeth Halton is going to die 1 week from now. Unless we can somehow find her and free her first.
Carter walked over to the window and peered out toward the leafless trees along the river. You've been in a position like this, Gabriel. What would you do if you were the president?
I'd tell my biggest, meanest sons of bitches to do whatever it takes to find her.
And if we can't, do we make a deal and save our child from the barbarians? Gabriel left the question unanswered. Carter gazed silently out the window for a moment.
My doctor says the stress of this job is bad for my heart. He says I need to get more exercise.
Take a walk with me, Gabriel. It will do us both good.
It's 20 degrees outside.
The cold air is good for you, Carter said. It lends clarity to one's thoughts. It steals one's resolve for the travails that lay ahead.
They slipped from the OHB through a side exit and set out along a paved jogging trail through the trees overlooking the river. Carter was bundled in a thick toggle coat and wool hat. Gabriel had only the leather jacket he'd taken with him the previous morning to Cyprus, and within a few moments, he was numb with cold.
All right, Carter said. No one's listening now. How did you know they were going to strike in London?
No one's listening? Gabriel looked around at the trees. This place is littered with cameras, motion sensors, and hidden microphones.
That's true, said Carter. But answer the question anyway.
Gabriel told him about the tip he had received from Ibrahim Fawaz, the photographs he discovered during his hasty search of Samir al-Masri's apartment, and the lines on the legal pad he had correctly identified as a sketch of Hyde Park.
Amazing, said Carter with genuine admiration in his voice. And what was the great Gabriel Alon doing in Amsterdam?
I'm afraid you don't get to know that part of the story.
Carter, a consummate professional, moved on without objection.
Ibrahim Fawaz sounds like exactly the sort of Muslim we've been looking for. A man who's willing to expose the extremists and terrorists residing within his community and his mosque.
That's what I thought too. Unfortunately, there's a catch.
Inside that suitcase I brought with me is a substantial portion of the SSI's dossier on the Sword of Allah. Guess whose file I found in there?
Your source is Sword of Allah?
Gabriel nodded.
Before leaving Egypt, Dr. Ibrahim Fawaz served as a professor of economics at the University of Minya. According to his file, he was one of the group's earliest organizers. He was arrested after Sadat's assassination. The file is a bit vague on the reasons why, along with the duration of his detainment.
They usually are, Carter said. Why did he leave Egypt and come to Europe, and why did he tell you there was a plot being organized from within the El Hijra Mosque in West Amsterdam?
Obviously, someone needs to put those very questions to him, and sooner rather than later.
He lied to me, or didn't tell me the whole story. Either way, he was being deceptive.
He's hiding something, Adrian.
They came to the intersection of two pathways. Carter guided Gabriel to the left, and together they set out through a stand of leafless trees. Carter dug a pipe and a pouch of tobacco from the pocket of his overcoat, and slowly loaded the bowl.
They don't let us smoke in the building anymore, he said, pausing to ignite the tobacco with an elegant silver lighter.
I wish we'd pass a similar rule.
Can you imagine Shamroon without his Turkish cigarettes?
Carter started walking again, trailing a plume of maple-scented smoke behind him like a steam engine.
I suppose we have two options. Option one, we pass along your information about Fawaz to the Dutch police and allow them to bring him in for questioning. With the FBI in close attendance, of course.
Option number two?
We pick him up for an off-the-record chat, in a place where the usual rules of interrogation don't apply.
You know which option I would vote for.
I'm glad you feel that way, Carter said. I think you should go to Amsterdam and personally supervise the operation.
Me?
Gabriel shook his head.
I'm afraid my role in this affair is officially over.
Besides, it's not as if the CIA doesn't have experience in these kinds of operations.
We do indeed, Carter said.
But unfortunately, we've screwed up quite a few of them. Under my watch, I'm ashamed to say. The Europeans are no longer willing to turn a blind eye to our extra-legal activities on their soil. And our own covert operatives are so afraid of prosecution at home and abroad that they no longer undertake sensitive missions without first consulting a lawyer.
Our intrepid director has his finger firmly in the air and has detected that, for the moment, the wind is no longer at our backs. The days when we roamed Europe and the Middle East, breaking laws and limbs as we saw fit, are now over. The doors of the secret prisons are now closed, and we no longer deliver our enemies into the hands of men who dream up novel uses for rubber hoses and cattle prods. We've put away our brass knuckles. We're a club fit for gentlemen from Princeton and Yale again. But that's as it should be. We like to keep our gentlemen from Princeton and Yale confined to Kingsall Boulevard, where they can't get into trouble. Carter walked in silence for a moment, with his eyes on the pavement. We've been preparing for something like this to happen for a long time. Our brethren at the FBI have overall responsibility for hostage recovery efforts under a scenario like this. We are gathering intelligence, of course, and liaising with allied services in Europe and the Middle East. We would regard you and your team as a black element of our larger multinational effort. You would, in effect, be a subcontractor of the agency. It's unconventional, but given our past association, I think we can make it work. I would need the approval of the Prime Minister. Gabriel hesitated. And, of course, Shemron would have to sign off on it. I'll set up a secure link to Jerusalem from my office. I promise, no one will listen in. I'll call from our embassy, if you don't mind. Suit yourself. Carter paused and knocked his pipe against the trunk of a tree. Did your source happen to tell you who he thinks is behind this? Gabriel answered the question. Carter nodded and stuffed more tobacco into his pipe. We know all about the Sphinx, he said. We think he's the one who planned the attack on the tourists at the pyramids 3 years ago that left 17 Americans dead. We also think he's responsible for the murder of two of our diplomats in Cairo. One of them was CIA, by the way. There's a star for him on the wall in the main lobby. I'm afraid the Sphinx has something of a reputation when it comes to dealing with those who arrest or kill SWORD personnel. Thanks to your efforts in London, you can be sure you're at the top of his hit list. You'll need to watch your step when you're back in the field. I assume you've told the Egyptians about the video? And the demands? We felt we had no choice, Carter said. They've pledged their full support, and they've also made it clear to us that caving into the SWORD's demands would be a very bad idea. The Egyptian foreign minister is traveling to Washington secretly later today to reinforce that point with the Secretary of State and the President. He's bringing along a team from the Interior Ministry and representatives of all the Egyptian security and intelligence services. We're adding Egyptian components to our task force here and in London. Just make sure no one mentions our little black operation in front of them. The Islamists have penetrated every level of Egyptian society and government, including the security services. You can be sure the Sphinx has contacts inside the SSI. Your operation does not exist, and no one will know about it but me. Carter looked at his watch. How long will it take you to deploy in Amsterdam? I have a man there already who can begin surveillance of the target immediately. One man? I hope he's good. He is. And the rest of your team? 48 hours? That leaves only 5 days before the deadline, Carter said. Take my plane back to Ben-Gurion. That will save you several critical hours. We'll need someone from the agency on your team in order to coordinate your activities with the larger effort. Otherwise, we run the risk of tripping over each other in the field. I don't want anyone from the CIA on my team. He'll just get in the way. And besides, I fully anticipate we'll be doing things that violate American law. I can't have him stopping every 5 minutes to consult with his Washington lawyer. I'm afraid I have to insist. All right, Adrian. We'll let you come along. Nothing would make me happier. But leaving headquarters is not an option, at least not at the moment. I do have another candidate in mind, someone who's experienced in the field and has been forged by fire. And the best part is, you trained her. Gabriel stopped walking. You can't be serious.
I'm quite serious.
Where is she?
The Saudi desk at the Counterterrorism Center.
How soon can she be ready to leave?
I'll make one phone call, and she's yours.
This is the end of disc number 4. Please continue listening on disc number 5.